Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Heroic mothering. That's how Claudia Malacrida of the University of Lethbridge describes the efforts of women with children suffering from attention deficit disorder. Her research will soon be published in a book called Cold Comfort, Mothers, Professionals, and ADD. And conservation. Dr. Mark Boyce gives an overview of his activities as the Alberta Conservation Association Chair in Wildlife and Fisheries at the University of Alberta. And Sophie Chetwertinsky, one of Mark's PhD students, talks about her work with black bears and the impact of industrial access and hunting. These are the stories you'll hear on this edition of Innovation Alberta. It was 10 years ago that Claudia Malacrida's daughter was diagnosed with attention deficit disorder. It was a period fraught with incredible difficulties, as mom worked her way through the medical and educational systems to do whatever she could to improve her daughter's situation. Today, Claudia is an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Lethbridge, and ADD is now the focus of her research. Her soon-to-be-released book, Cold Comfort, is a comparative study of the experiences of mothers with attention deficit children in Canada and the United Kingdom. With different criteria for diagnosis, there's only one case of ADD in the UK for every 100 cases in Canada.
Well, I think, first of all, in Canada, there's been a strong history of medicine and psychiatry working together and a strong psychology background where labeling is really an accepted practice. In the UK, it's much more psychoanalytical, so they think labeling is very bad.
How does that affect the women then and the children?
Well, it's an excellent question, and I think the most interesting part of this is I was interested in going to England because I thought I'd find very different things because of these differing rates of diagnosis. And in fact, what I found was a profoundly shared experience between mothers in England and mothers in Canada. Despite whether a label was accepted or not, they ran aground of educators, they ran aground of medical professionals. They had to search long and hard and through very complex routes to get a label that actually fit for their children. They experienced profound personal blame and responsibility from not only the professionals who I listed before, but their family members and, you know, people in the community and those kinds of things. So although there were some differences in the way that the actual treatment or labeling process would occur, the experiences of women were very, very similar.
Give me some examples. Are women finding that they have a difficult time getting the support that they need to deal with their children?
In the first instance, women found it very difficult to find a label. The first assumption when a child seemed to hit trouble, and usually that trouble happened when a child entered into the public schooling system, would be an assumption that there was something wrong with the family. That would be the first order of business. It was more pronounced in the UK, and I spoke with women who had been in family therapy, which usually meant the mother and the child because dad often didn't go, and they'd been in therapy for literally like 7-8 years before they ever got to, let's move beyond seeing what's wrong with the family and maybe check this child out medically. So those kinds of things were very difficult for women because they felt themselves needing to defend themselves on a lot of fronts. If a woman was divorced, if she was a single mother, if she was poor, if she was an immigrant, lots of those kinds of discourses would come up in professional interactions.
So it's looked at from a sociological or a blame kind of way rather than an actual medical problem.
I think that's usually how women themselves perceived it. They knew that when they were called into the meetings at the school or when they were called in for the conferences or when it was suggested that they go for therapy, that there was some notion that they were somehow being held culpable for this. And, of course, in the public arena, that moment when you're standing in Safeway and your child is screaming and yelling and hanging onto your leg and the lady in front of you says, "Lady, can't you do something about your kid?" only reinforces those notions.
What did you actually do in order to get the information to do the interviews?
I do a process called narrative analysis. So my interviews always begin really with this very open question that is, tell me how it is that you first came to think of your child as different. And in that way, mothers were able to tell me when things started to really run amok. And again, more often than not, this was once the child sort of left the cocoon of early childhood and either went into kindergarten or into grade school.
Well, let's look at their individual stories. What are the concerns?
Well, I think one of the concerns that was overarching in both sites was the idea that these were children who were in profound pain. They were socially isolated from their schoolmates. They often had really negative interactions with teachers. Seemed to, some kids picked nails, some kids pulled hair out. I mean, lots and lots of evidence of unhappiness. And mothers found really interesting ways to try and help their children. So one of the things I do talk about in the book is sort of heroic mothering. And particularly in Canada, almost all of the mothers had volunteered in the classroom, had been in the PTA, had taken up a job on school bus or in the playground as a lunchroom monitor, all of that kind of thing. And the reasons that they gave for doing this was not because they really wanted to contribute so much to their community, but that this was a way for them to have some surveillance over what they feared was happening in the classroom. And very often there were stories to be told about children who were... Some of the literature says that kids should be given really directed tasks and should be sort of put in non-distracting environments. So one woman spoke about going into the classroom and finding her child in a cardboard box up against the front of the blackboard in a way that she felt was wrong. And when she talked to the teacher about it, it's like, well, you know, this is what I'm supposed to do. This is non-distracting.
Having gone through all the interviews and looked at the different situations, what would be your ultimate conclusion on this situation?
The one thing I will say about the UK is that once a child actually got himself or herself labeled, and that label was indeed rarely ADD. Very often it would be something like dyslexia, or, you know, there were other categories that a very creative mother and a very creative medical group might find for this child. Then money was attached to that. In very many cases where there was that kind of experience, things weren't so bad. The child was, given a school that worked for them, tutoring, you know, a laptop computer, all of those kinds of things that would be beneficial for the child. Whereas in Canada, when the label comes, and in the Calgary board at the time of the study, it was less than $400 that followed a child per school year for a mild disability label. So, you know, and that went into the general pot of the school, so it didn't really help in any way, shape, or form. So it's not quite as straightforward as saying, you know, what worked and what didn't work, but generally it was hard work in both sites, and I think not with a guaranteed outcome in either of them.
What would be your message for women who are mothers of children with ADD?
I think my first message would be that the dream of the team is an illusion. Very much of educational and medical rhetoric around family and around disability is that mothers and families and teachers and professionals are all part of a team. And from what I heard from women, that's simply not been the case in their experiences. And as soon as women did finally get that, things started to clear up. They had to fight hard and long and sort of let go a lot of their illusions. But when they really were able to let go the dream that everybody was interested in the same things and was on the same page, that was a moment when actually things might go somewhere for them.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Claudia Malacrida, an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Lethbridge. Her book will be released in the spring, and it's called Cold Comfort: Mothers, Professionals, and Attention Deficit Disorder. Every time you buy a hunting or fishing license in Alberta, a portion of that fee goes towards research supported by the Alberta Conservation Association. One of the most important initiatives of the ACA has been the establishment of a research chair in wildlife and fisheries at the University of Alberta. And the person occupying that chair is Dr. Mark Boyce. Mark comes to Alberta by way of the University of Wyoming, where he studied elk and sage grouse, and the University of Wisconsin, where grizzly bears caught his attention. I asked Mark what he perceived as the big conservation issues in Alberta.
Well, there are a number of conservation issues related to industrial development, for example, and coming up with optimal harvesting strategies for various species that ensure that we are able to continue to harvest these populations for the long term. There have been some populations that have been over-harvested, and we need to cut back on some of those. There are other populations that are potentially threatened with extirpation if we don't do something different in terms of habitat management or in terms of harvest management. I think the bottom line, though, as it relates to wildlife conservation issues in Alberta, relate to habitat. And that's where the potential issues related to oil and gas development, agricultural development, forest development, and other industrial development in the province can come in conflict with wildlife values.
You have quite an extensive research program set up now and a number of grad students who are working with you. What are some of those project areas?
I have five students who are working on bears, and nearly all of them are doing research related to bear habitats. So industrial development, for example, along the east slopes is potentially having serious consequences to grizzly bear populations. There are also interesting issues related to the hunt that occurs for black bears and also grizzly bears in the province of Alberta. I have students working on sage grouse. I have a student working on sage grouse, which is a critically endangered species in Alberta. In Wyoming, where I used to be, we had maybe 500,000 sage grouse, and there wasn't nearly the anxiety about population levels there. But here we're down to just seven dancing grounds, seven leks, where the birds persist down in the southeastern corner of the province near many berries. So Cam Aldridge is my PhD student studying habitats and populations of sage grouse in southeastern Alberta. I have a couple of graduate students who are employees of the Alberta government who work for the Ministry of Sustainable Resource Development, who are coming back to do their masters. One of these is Travis Ripley, who is studying bull trout populations in northwestern Alberta, and Kirby Smith, who's studying woodland caribou in western Alberta, survival models of woodland caribou. I have other students working on elk and wolf predation on elk. I have a student working on population fluctuations in mink across Canada. Chris Johnson is a postdoc working with me on grizzly bear survival models and habitat models. And another student, Danielle Fortin, a postdoc, who is working on foraging by elk and vegetation that's important for perpetuating healthy elk populations.
What are some of the things that you're actually finding out that through your students that are surprising to you? Like, I haven't heard about mink for a long time, yet my grandmother used to raise mink back in the 30s.
Mink populations undergo some amazing cycles, and they're with about a 10-year cycle, which is similar to the cycles that occur in lynx and snowshoe hares that many people know about. But mink, being in a semi-aquatic carnivore, spend a lot of time in aquatic habitats underneath the ice in the wintertime, for example, and remarkably have a 10-year cycle as well. as do the muskrats that are their primary prey. We're trying to understand some of the mechanisms that create the 10-year cycle in muskrats and mink. But mink are of particular interest because of their influence on whooping cranes that nest in northeastern Alberta in Wood Buffalo National Park and adjacent areas in the Northwest Territories. Whooping cranes were sort of the icon for conservation 50 years ago. Numbers of whooping cranes worldwide were down to 16 birds. And in 1942, and since then they've increased, we now have 179 birds in the Wood Buffalo Aransas population of whooping cranes. But every 10 years, there's a real dip in recruitment of young whooping cranes, and that appears to be related to predators. And mink and lynx populations coincide with dips in the recruitment of whooping cranes. And we're trying to untangle the conservation ramifications of predation on whooping crane chicks in northeastern Alberta.
How do you deal with the issue of knowledge transfer? A lot of research gets done, but then one of the problems is how do you get it into a forum where it can be used to the benefit of public policy making? Does it help having a group like the ACA supporting your chair with this knowledge transfer issue?
That's a very difficult question to answer very very quickly, because there are many ways that knowledge transfer takes place. For example, I'm on the grizzly bear recovery team, and so my experience in research on grizzly bears is transferred into policy through the recommendations that come out of our team. The bottom line, as it relates to academic productivity and how academics are evaluated, relates to peer-reviewed publications. But oftentimes these are technical publications that are inaccessible to the general public and sometimes even to managers, because they may focus on mathematical models or complicated statistical analyses that may not be very transparent in context of their implications for management. And so I think that that's why this interface between ACA, University of Alberta, and SRD, Sustainable Resource Development, that's facilitated through my chair is an important one, to try to ensure that there is this linkage between the ACA with a focus on habitats, with SRD with a focus on populations and harvest management, and the university with research capability and lots of willing and eager graduate students to do the field research.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
That was Dr. Mark Boyce. He holds the Alberta Conservation Association Chair in Wildlife and Fisheries at the University of Alberta. One of the PhD candidates working under the supervision of Dr. Mark Boyce at the University of Alberta is Sophie Chet-Rutinsky. Sophie is studying black bears in hunted and unhunted populations in northeastern Alberta, such as those in the Cold Lake Air Weapons Range. Her particular interest is the relationship between industrial development, the access it creates for hunters, and the impact that has on black bears. When I talked with Sophie at this time last year, she had just finished a summer of capturing bears and had collared 86 of them for the study. I recently caught up with Sophie just before she headed out into the field for a second season of checking her bears, which are holed up in their dens for the winter.
Well, bears don't hibernate. It's called torpor, and you can kind of call it, I guess, a deep sleep. So they do wake up once you approach the den.
So how do you actually do all of those things? So you have to weigh the bear and that. What's involved in that?
Well, once you get to the den, we usually already have an estimate of how much the bear weighs, so we know exactly how much drug it'll require. And you crawl into the den as quietly as possible,
inject the bear with some drug, close up the den again, wait for them to fall asleep, and only once they're asleep, then you actually take them out of the den along with their cubs. And then you start doing all of the manipulations. So we pull the bears out, we weigh them using a chain winch, and take all the measurements, blood samples, etc. And then we put them back into the den and cover it all up exactly the way we found it.
Now that's the winter work that you did. How about your summer work?
Well, the summer work this past season was very similar to the first, except that it wasn't as intensive. What we basically wanted to do is to replace the collars that were lost from some of the bears being hunted and others simply dropping collars to make sure that we get our sample size back to what it was in the first year.
Did you lose a lot of bears?
I guess on average we had about 15% of our bears that were hunted legally and another 10 bears that dropped collars throughout the summer.
What are some of the things that you found out now that you have some of this data behind you?
We've actually got some pretty interesting results. One of the first things we saw is from data that we collected during the first summer. And when we extract a tooth from the bear, what we can do is tell exactly what age all of the individuals are. And so from that, we get an idea of the population structure of the populations. And if we compare hunted to unhunted populations, we see some definite differences. The most significant difference that we see is in the male segment of the population. If we look at the unhunted area in the Cold Lake Air Weapons Range, almost all of the individuals are aged 4 or 5 and above, and that's very different from the hunted population, where the majority of the individuals are in the subadult age category, so 2, 3, 4 years old.
What does that mean?
A lot of it means that, generally speaking, adult males are the ones that are most sought for by hunters, and so obviously they're the ones that are eliminated from the population. But what this also means is that once dominant males are removed, it seems to leave place for a lot of these younger individuals which aren't present in the unhunted population.
How about the females? What have you found there with their populations?
Interestingly enough, in the female segment of the population, we seem to see the same trend. In both hunted and unhunted areas, adult females aged 5 and above seem to represent the greater part of the portion of the population. However, of course, in the unhunted area, this proportion is a lot greater. We see approximately 80% of the females captured are aged 5 and above.
If hunting does seem to be making a difference to the bears, are there as many males as females, or how does that work out?
This is a little counterintuitive, actually, because you'd expect there to be more females in a population that was hunted where hunters were looking for large males, but it's actually not the case. If you look at in our hunted population, what we find is a majority of subadult bears, and overall we actually captured more males than females. So not only are there more subadult males than adult males, there's actually more males than females in the hunted population. And this is different than what we found in our unhunted population in the Cold Lake Air Weapons Range, where the majority of bears captured were females.
What do you think accounts for that?
Well, we really don't know, and there's probably several possibilities. One of them could be simply the presence of these large adult males that may keep these younger subadult males out of the areas where they have their home ranges. Another possibility could also be a very high density of adult females, which could also be forcing some of those younger bears outside of the area. So at the present time, we really can't say, but it's definitely an interesting question that hopefully we'll answer by the end of the study.
What are some other things that you found?
One of the most interesting differences that we found between the hunted and unhunted populations is a difference in nutritional condition of the animals. First of all, if we look at nutritional condition between males of the hunted and unhunted populations, we really don't see any significant difference in their weights. And so what that seems to suggest is that habitat is not limiting the weight in these two populations, or is not differentially limiting their weight. So in other words, the habitat in both the hunted and unhunted areas seems to be giving them the same nutritional requirements.
That's for the males, though.
Yes, that's for the males. And what's interesting is that when we look at the female segment of the population, what we see is a difference in nutritional condition. The females in the hunted area seem to be in better nutritional condition than the females in the Cold Lake Air Weapons Range.
Now, why is that?
Well, that's probably going to be one of the toughest questions to answer. And again, this is just the first year of the study, so whether or not this trend will hold after this winter's data is also another question. one thing that we do plan on doing is using some of the data that we're going to get from our GPS collars. These collars allow us to get data every hour on the hour on individual bears. And so using digitized vegetation maps, what we'll be able to do is identify the types of habitats that both males and females in both of the study areas are using. And from that, be able to maybe tease apart possibly differences in habitat use that may be able to explain the differences that we see in weights.
Could it be that the males get out there, eat up all the food, and then the females are kind of left to scavenge?
Well, eat up all the food would be difficult since we're talking about vegetation. But what could be possible is simply that the males, or this is one possibility, that the males in the large males in the air weapons range could simply be forcing the females out of better habitat. So it's not that the females there are reproducing and they're not in bad nutritional condition, but they possibly could be forcing them outside of good habitat. Of course, there's the other possibility that there's just a high density of large adult females, and that limits their food intake.
You've been spending an awful lot of time with these bears and following them around. What are some of the neat things you're finding out about these bears?
Well, other than the fact that they seem to scare me more and more every year, I think one of the things that surprised me most is how easily accessible most of the dens are. And it's not as far as easy to cross the forest where you need to walk to find it, but it's the distance that they are from most of the cut lines and seismic lines. Usually when you do den work out west or even further out east, most of it's done by helicopter because dens are so hard to access. We have so many cut lines in northern Alberta that it actually makes it quite easy to visit the dens. But what was surprising on top of it is that most of the bears didn't seem to go too far away from a lot of these cut lines before digging their dens. Sometimes dens were found literally 20 meters off of a cut line where you have traffic going by from oil companies.
Well, that's amazing. They don't seem to mind the people then.
Well, that probably depends on how close they get. We did find several bears that denned above ground. So actually just had a big nest on the snow and even had cubs of the year with them. And so we're wondering whether or not those dens were possibly disturbed throughout the winter from a new cut line or seismic line being put in, or possibly that's just the way they den, because those kind of observations have been made before. So it'll be interesting to see if those individuals have the same types of dens this winter.
Thank you very much, Sophie.
Thank you.
That was Sophie Chetwertinsky, a PhD candidate in biological sciences at the University of Alberta. She's researching the effects of industrial development, access, and hunting on black bears in northeastern Alberta. Her work is supported by many organizations, including the Alberta Conservation Association and the Alberta Professional Outfitters Society. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during the program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website. The web address is innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to the weekly Innovation Alberta online newsletter. It's free. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Conservation Association, Alberta Ingenuity Fund, Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, the National Institute for Nanotechnology, Alberta Research Council, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, True North Energy, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, the Health Sciences Association of Alberta, and the Capital Region Innovation Centre. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.